This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Eric Hodge, in for Frank Stacio. Haven Kimmel began a writing career as a 9-year-old child in Moreland, Indiana, by copying Ray Bradbury's stories onto paper, showing them to her mother, and declaring them her own. A dubious beginning, perhaps, but a terrific lesson in craft as she went from plagiarizing Ray Bradbury to what she considered improving Ray Bradbury, adding some exploding body parts here and there, and finally just abandoning old Ray altogether for her own inventions. Two novels and one best-selling memoir later, Haven Kimmel is back. The Durham-based writer's new book, She Got Up Off the Couch and Other Heroic Acts from Moreland, Indiana, continues the adventures of the main character and a girl named Zippy. Haven Kimmel joins us now in the studio. Welcome, Haven.
Thank you, Eric.
This book moves the focus off of Zippy a little bit, but the narrative is still hers, and it's still in her voice. It may seem like an obvious question, but her voice is your voice, yes?
Well, that certainly was what I attempted in the first book. And it's very difficult to recreate the voice of your own childhood. And fortunately, I had my mother and my sister to help me in that task. And some people who have seen me read before have heard me say that in the early drafts of Zippy, I would call my mother and read it aloud to her and say, "Does this sound like me?" And she would sigh in this sort of exhausted way and say, "Yes, alas, it does." So I think the more that I exhausted my mother and sister, the closer I was to the truth.
What's the time span between the two books? You wrote the first one in what year was it?
I wrote the first book in 2000.
Right.
And it was published in 2001, and so there's been about 4 years between them.
So you had to put yourself back into that character after having abandoned it for 4 years.
I did. Fortunately, she was dormant. She was just lying there waiting, like a vampire. And in truth, it was a very interesting exercise because my editor had originally taken 50 pages out of Zippy for a sequel, which I swore I would never write. I thought they would just be lost forever. And so I had those 50 pages as a kind of entryway to walk back through. And it helped a lot. It was a very wise move on her. It was very prescient on her part to think of that.
Right, but you didn't have to go back and start rereading your own book.
No. No, thank goodness. That would have been tedious.
So after your two novels that were also really about Moreland, Indiana, why did you return to memoir? Why did you come back to this after 4 years?
It was peer pressure.
It was.
I was pressured. Yes. People were very – I was surprised at how interested people were. I considered Zippy to be a finite object. I thought that it was a thing that was done all – of its own and existed solely on its own. But other people really sensed a continuing narrative, my audience members. When I say other people, I don't mean the president. And so I would, at readings and events, people were very interested in what happened next. And I would try to say kindly, let's pretend there was no next. Let's pretend that the book ended right there. And
which it did.
For me it did. But then I started to think, oh, it is possible to continue that narrative, given that we did go on living, and that the stories were interesting. The story got more interesting, really. And as I say, I think I said in the introduction to this that part of the reason I was willing to write a sequel is because it's really a book with a plot, and the plot was engaging to me, and I thought it was an important story to tell about women in the 70s and the incredible journey that women took during that time.
Well, your mom makes some amazing changes that happened to her in the book, and most of them she instigates herself, and she just decides to get up and do it. Explain that.
Well, you could say that she instigated them herself, or you could say that she was guided by the Holy Spirit, which is what she thought at the time.
Really?
She did. I think that she always felt a kind of, you know, I was raised a Quaker, and in the sort of middle of the road evangelical Quaker tradition, which is not well known in North Carolina, but it's much more ministerial. It's more evangelical, and I think that Mother always felt what she called a leaning, and I don't know exactly what she meant by it, but it did seem to mean that she felt somebody leaning on her. Not that she was leaning a particular direction herself. And that leaning was toward going back to school. And I think, as I said it, when I read at the Regulator two nights ago, I said I think that what she wanted to do most of all. It was not so much a matter of ambition. It was a matter of freeing herself from the chains of ignorance. And that it really, that really ate away at her for years and years when she was not doing it. And so she threw down a fleece, which is a phrase that was used often in our meeting. And I don't know if it's, maybe we invented it, but it's a sort of unbreakable contract with God. You say, I will do X if. And she threw down a fleece that if she saw a particular commercial for the CLEP test, the college level entrance placement exam, she would take it.
But there was a time limit, wasn't there?
There was a time limit. Yeah. Yeah, because you can't just give God complete leeway.
No.
You know, heaven's sakes.
It could take 10 years.
It could take 1,000. So there was a time limit, and the time limit was fulfilled, and then she was obliged.
Just in the nick of time, though.
In the nick of time. That's exactly right. So after that, then, after that, it was all on her own impetus that she did everything, after the fleece was fulfilled.
She is, you see her as emblematic of her generation, you know, and you said that that really is the plot of this book. Why is that?
Well, I did not think of her that way until I was myself an undergraduate literature major, and in a women's studies class, I read The Women's Room by Marilyn French. Many, many, many people read The Women's Room by Marilyn French in women's studies classes. And I realized that even though that story takes place in a wholly different world, and that woman, I believe, goes to Harvard, goes to extension classes at Harvard, that her story was very similar to my mother's. There was the obstacles were specific in the 60s and 70s to women leaving their house and ceasing to be domestics, really. And my mother's obstacles were so numerous and so varied that they were comical. Now they're comical.
Right.
When I was writing the book and empathizing with her more fully than ever, I couldn't believe it. You know, I would think she did this and then she did this with no driver's license and no it was shocking, and it made me very, very tired to consider what she went through. And I think that if you remove the specifics, it's what women went through all over the country trying to make professional lives or trying to educate themselves.
Well, there's also a part in the book where you describe how, you know, she feels like she never even could be a domestic because, as she put it, there wasn't a washing machine and there was no laundry to wash had there been one.
Exactly.
And the list is quite long about, you know, things that were missing from her life.
Right, that's right. And there are some women who have more of a pioneer spirit, I think, and who would have carved something out of that nothingness in a different way than my mother did. But she chose instead to sit down and read. And that's something that she certainly could be judged for, I think, but it served her well in the end. It served me well in the end. You know, I've gotten 2 books out of it.
Sure. Well, absolutely. Well, and you know, clearly in that very literal sense, it was an inspiration to you. But in terms of how you've lived your life and the challenges you've faced and how you tackled them, has it been an inspiration to you watching your mom be able to do that?
Oh, absolutely. And not only what she achieved, but that she achieved all of it with such good humor. You know, even really when she was when her life, the situation in her life was most desperate, on the couch with Isaac Asimov and the pork rinds, she was always in a good mood. And I think the reason was because, I just talked to a friend about this last night, because she had a deeply ingrained belief that you live life as it is, not as you wish it would be, but you just take what is in front of you. And that is more important than anything else she taught me. And so the notion not only that you can get up and do the thing that you need to do, but that you can do it with good humor is basically all a child needs to know, I think.
And she was completely unflappable.
She was.
You know, and it's not without reason. I mean, there were a lot of things coming her way, and she would always just sort of look up from the page and say, well, thank you very much.
Exactly.
Right back to it.
That's exactly right. And then later, she taught me the critical question that you ask when someone says no to you. You ask, who will tell me yes? And you just keep going. So if this person in the provost's office says no, who will tell me yes? And you redirect that question. And in fact, you can wear away institutions that way. That's a it's a Quaker method of problem solving.
Well, and when you know, and when her husband said that that had been a form letter that the president of the college had sent to her upon her graduation, inviting her to come have a personal one-on-one meeting with him. And, you know, she just wasn't willing to accept that and just went and had the meeting. And the president was more surprised than anybody that she even showed up.
Exactly, exactly. And, of course, the embarrassment then was his, not hers, that he would, in fact, send a form letter to a graduating class and someone would believe in his credibility and call him on it.
Absolutely. You write as if you're still living in Moreland, and I'm curious as to how you maintain that connection with that town.
Well, I think that the place that you grow up, and I lived there 16 years before Mother and I moved, and I think the place that you grow up gets in you in a way that no place ever does again. The kind of resonance and the coming to one's senses. You know, I came to all of my knowledge of the world in that little postage stamp of native soil. And so everything since then has been a comparison. I moved to the Mississippi Gulf Coast, and it isn't just that I learned what I learned about the Mississippi Gulf Coast, I learned it in comparison to Moreland, Indiana. Everything stands in relation to that first that first thing I knew. And so it's very simple to go back there. It's easier to go back there than any place else I know.
Is there something specific about that that is a writerly process, or is that just a process of a grown-up remembering their childhood?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question, since I don't have any mind that isn't writerly. I would like to know. I think that my sister never left Moreland. She still has a Moreland.
Still there.
Yeah, she still has a Moreland zip code, and when I write a letter to her and I write that on the outside of the envelope, there's always this moment of shock, as if I were sending a letter to Pompeii. You know, there are still people there. It's so shocking, and they go right on living their lives, and it's not romanticized, or it isn't cast in this nostalgic light for her. It's really just concrete, actual Moreland, Indiana. And so that helps me a great deal. That prevents me from turning it into some sepia-toned falsehood, really.
Right.
Because when I go back to see her, there are the horses that need vaccinating. There are the goats. There's the dog barking. It's all, you know, it's just life.
Has it grown a lot since you left, or is it just the same place it always was?
It has not grown a smidge. In fact, the first time I took my husband John there and we drove through it, he said, I feel like I'm back in the book. I feel like I'm back in 1965 or 1970. Change is just, it's glacial in that area. And I don't know why. It probably has to do with low pressure systems. I don't know.
What's the nearest city? Where were the bright city lights?
Oh, dear, you'll laugh when I say it, but Newcastle, Indiana.
Another major metropolitan area.
I know. There were 20, Newcastle has a population of 20,000, and that just seemed huge. It seemed unknowable. You know, how could you possibly ever learn everything there was to learn about Newcastle? The people who lived there, I would look at them in awe. You know, you understand the streets and the stoplights. There were no stoplights in Moreland. And now I sound like I'm reporting from a mental institution, but in fact it was, and then to go even farther, Muncie was the next town, which is about 150,000, and then Indianapolis, the major metropolitan area, is about 1 million people. And so, you know, talking about 1 million people is like talking about the distance between two planets.
Sure.
You know, there, it just, you can't make sense of it.
Well, how do you find life in Durham? How are things different here from Moreland, Indiana?
I honestly believe that Durham is the most perfect city in the world. I do. I believe that every day. And
Chamber of Commerce would like to speak to you.
I would be perfectly happy to serve them. That, you know, the weather, the people, the way that everything is so, it's a beautiful place and it's so funky and elegant at the same time. It has everything you could possibly want. And so coming from a place like Moreland, Indiana, I feel as though I've stumbled into Shangri-La. You know, that to think that on any given occasion, I can eat at a restaurant. I've lived here 10 years, and I can still go to restaurants I've never been to before, which is, I don't even know what that means. How do they do that? It's like magic. And then to have the kind of support that I personally have, I read at the regulator, not last night, but the night before, and the regulator was completely packed with people, you know, beyond standing room only for, you know, for this silly little book. And when I looked out, I saw probably 20 people who have been present at the launch of every one of my books. And they're strangers to me, but they're always there.
They're your number one fans.
They're my number one fans. That devotion is somehow connected to this place. So I'm very, very grateful to live here.
And you're comfortable in the South, aren't you? You feel like this is an extension of your home.
I do. This part of the South is far less Southern than where I grew up. I grew up with hillbillies, and so this is the very sophisticated South compared to Moreland, where everyone had come from the same holler in Kentucky. And the way that people talked, the way that my grandmother talked, her Southern accent was so deep compared to the people here that when I moved to North Carolina, I thought, well, I've come home in a sort of spiritual way, but better. It's better. It's an improvement. So yes, I would never leave the South.
There are more restaurants.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about the telephone for a moment. As it appears in your book, it is almost a character. And you're able to, as a child, find out just about everything you need to know about the comings and goings of your mother just by sitting on the other end of the couch and listening to her talk.
That's right. And in fact, my father, that leads to an interesting thing that my father said when he first read the completed manuscript of Zippy. He was a man of few words, and we met for a cookout in a park, and he wouldn't look me in the eye, which was also typical, and so he sort of looked out in the distance. He was smoking a cigarette, and he said, well, here's what I have to say about that. You never know who's listening. And I said, right, that's right. No one ever would have guessed that squirrely little 7-year-old girl with the crazy hair was paying very, very close attention to everything that went on around her. And I think my mom wasn't aware of it either. But so I did learn mostly everything I needed to know. And I think that's true for a lot of children. Children are always listening. So it changed the way that I raised my own children. You know, with my daughter, as soon as my daughter was born, I thought, I'm going to treat her as if every moment is the one moment she will recall, and just hope for the best, and then also hope that her memory's not very good and that she's not paying attention.
Well, that's a lot of pressure, though.
It really is.
Thinking that every moment of your life is the one that's the one your daughter's going to remember.
I know. It caused me to behave better than I would have otherwise.
Do you think that that text messaging and email is sort of spoiling the art of telephone conversation?
Or eavesdropping.
Well, there you
go. It's possibly.
It's more difficult. You have to look at the screen now.
I know. You really have to get behind somebody. You have to do things that are immoral in order to overhear the conversations between people, which is why I rely much more on email than the telephone.
You do.
I do.
Right.
I do.
Right, because it's more secretive.
It's very private.
Yeah. What about instant messaging?
I've never done that. I feel like, you have to draw the line somewhere, and I've decided not to learn any more technology. I'm stopping.
No matter what happens.
No, I'm done. That's it. I'm competent on a computer and I can write books on it, and then that's where I'm stopping, and I'm going to learn other things.
All right. Haven Kimmel is with us today. Her new book, She Got Up Off the Couch, is a follow-up to her best-selling memoir, A Girl Named Zippy. Just ahead, more with Haven Kimmel about the memoir and a debut of our new feature, Weird Science. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Eric Hodge in for Frank Stacio. Author Haven Kimmel is with us in the studio today. Her new book, She Got Up Off the Couch, continues the story of her family, friends, and neighbors in Moreland, Indiana. And Zippy really grows up before our eyes in this book. Although you've said you don't care for coming-of-age stories, it is sort of that, isn't it?
It is. In fact, I was just interviewed by John Valentine for The Independent, and he asked me why I thought coming-of-age books were so popular, why people love to read them. And I think the reason is because it is absolutely universal. It is the one universal thing. I could write about being a mother, and that would have a limited audience, even though it's a, you know, it's a deep, profound thing.
Sure.
But we all live on that precipice between childhood and adolescence and adulthood, and all of us experience that that stunning kind of change when we're in a when we're in the netherworld between two states, and that really is what the book is about, as much as anything else. In terms of the Zippy character as opposed to the mother character.
I'd like to ask you to read from the new book, if you would. This is actually a moment of change in Zippy's close and loving relationship with her father.
Right. This is in a chapter called Silver, which takes place on my parents' 25th wedding anniversary. So I would have been about 10 or 11 years old. And this particular passage you've chosen has a fair amount of pathos, and I would like to point out that most of the book is funnier. And
sure, it's more lighthearted.
It's more lighthearted, but this is in fact a fine example of that kind of change. And I think too, the way that watching my own children grow up, they don't know what they're experiencing in terms of that change at the moment that it's happening. You really only know it in retrospect.
Right.
All those millions of times I'd climbed into his lap. It was routine, so often rehearsed and fully memorized I'd never given it any thought. I was, in some critical way, a part of Dad's lap, and I fit inside the curve of his arm like a puzzle piece. There was a hollow place just below his collarbone that had been designed for my head. We were like the old married couple, Howie and Mickey. We were just going about our business, Dad somewhere, me somewhere else. But at the end of the day, or when I fell asleep in the car, or when I was sick, he picked me up, and we were that other person, just one person. This time, he didn't move. He didn't make the right adjustments or use his arm to pull me up closer and settle me in a position so he could see over my hair. His whole body was stiff. He seemed angry. "Hop up now," he said, his eyes fixed on the television. "You should be in bed." He might as well have hit me. It would have been better if he had hit me. For a moment, I just stood by his chair, but he didn't look at me or say anything else, so I stepped back over the crockpot, the books, the animals. I couldn't see where I was going, but I made it to the doorway without tripping. I was about to cross into the dark living room when he said, "You're a big girl now, too big to sit on my lap." I stopped, but didn't turn around. "And listen to me." His voice took on the tone he used when he was about to name a cardinal law, the defiance of which would result in punishment so dire it had no name and had never yet been employed. "You are not to sit on anyone else's lap either. Do you hear me?" I didn't have to look at him to know what his face was doing, the flame of him, his absolute authority. I said, "Do you hear me?" I nodded, my back still turned to him, and took off running. I ran past the piano, through the doorway into my parents' bedroom, where they never slept anymore, up the stairs. I nearly flew across the room that had been my sister's and onto my bed, where I lay on my stomach and buried my face in my pillow and hoped I would suffocate, a trick that had never worked. I didn't know what I had done. I could never ask, and he wouldn't tell me anyway, but somehow, through a failure of attention, or maybe it had been a series of small crimes added together, I had made him stop loving me. I had lost my father.
Broke your heart.
Yeah, he broke my heart. That's what fathers do, I think.
I guess so.
And children.
Yeah.
And children.
Families in general.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a heartbreaking experience.
But looking back at that time, you thought it was something that you had done, but actually it was just because you had grown up. Right?
Exactly. And he was protecting me. And it was interesting. I got to be in my late 20s, I think, and my sister and I were standing in my dad's barn, and we were talking about someone in the news, some man who had abused his children. And I'm the only one in my family who always says the thing out loud. You know, the rest of them still practice that great Midwestern taciturnity and reserve.
They think it, but they don't say it.
Exactly. Whereas I feel like life is short. Somebody needs to say it. And so I turned to him and I said, "You know, Dad, regardless of any criticism that your children could have against you, you never did that to us. You never threatened us in any way that was essential or, you know, that got to the soul of us. And I have always been immensely grateful to that for that. And that he would say to a 10-year-old, and it must have hurt him as much as it hurt me, that is over. That time has passed. And also, you must never allow anyone else to do this either, was, you know, that's what a father is supposed to do for his daughter.
And although, you know, this story is the story about your mom getting off the couch, it is really inextricably linked with your father and the things that are happening in his life. And he had his own dissatisfactions as well, didn't he?
He did. And the writing of this book for me was a way to say, I get it. I get it. You know, it seemed so black and white to everyone around us, and certainly in my family, that she did the right thing. She did the holy thing, but you know, choosing an education and choosing to live a more fully realized life, and he was bad because he said no, because he put up those obstacles. But in writing this book, you can't write any book without fully empathizing with all of your characters or it fails. And so I had to more fully empathize with my father than I ever had before. And when I saw from his point of view what was happening to his family, what this was going to cost all of us in the end, her decision, I realized his suffering in a way I never had before. And I'm very grateful that I did, because suddenly all those things that he had been criticized for all my life were just laid bare. And he really was trying to protect all of us, I think, in saying no to her. And that doesn't make it right. But he was doing the best he could with his own limited resources.
And probably it seemed like trying to protect himself and maybe the entire family from change. It's as if change is the worst thing that could happen. And yet there are times when he does have change in his life, whether it's, you know, deciding to volunteer and become a deputy, and mm-hmm. everything changes there. But it seems like there are large parts of the book where he's just pushing back against change.
That's right. Yeah, he was highly mobile, my father. And so that mobility, I think he had the comfort of that mobility because he could always come back to a place that was in complete stasis. You know, there she was. She never moved. That nothing in the house ever changed, except it got a little bit worse. And so he could fly.
And he didn't mind it getting worse.
Heck no. Yeah. No, it was fine. As long as we were all right there and everyone was safe. And then when she stepped away, all she had to do was get up and walk away once. And the whole facade just crumbled. Everything crumbled. And he must have sensed that is, in fact, the risk that you take with any kind of change, that either all of you band together as a family and you keep, you know, you keep the ball rolling even though it's a different ball, or you lose everything. And that's what he was afraid of, I'm sure.
And he must have been shocked when it happened. He must have thought that would never happen.
I'm certain that's what he thought. And it's not There's not much of that in this book, but in fact, he tried. He did. He stayed all during her undergraduate education. He took care of me during the years that she was at Ball State, and then during her master's work as well. I have a vivid memory of him at Blue River High School, where she was teaching at the time, standing behind a desk and collating copies of her master's thesis, like a dozen copies. You know, there had to be so many copies of it made. And I can see him doing that task for her, which is very significant. It was very significant at the time, the ways that he tried to help and also tried to stop her at the same time. I think that his conflictedness was great.
As it goes on, the end of the book foreshadows a time that could be a little more tricky for Zippy. As you say, the bulk of this is very lighthearted and extremely humorous, and you read it and you do chuckle out loud. But as you get toward the end of the book, was it hard to get to that place, to what's happening there at the end?
It was. It was just painful in the way that anyone's family story is painful. But it was also artistically more difficult, which I am glad that you saw. I used to say about Zippy that the book had a different, that's not my title. The title that it had was Qualities of Light, or Disasters Involving Animals. That was the original title. And so what I intended to do was to write one book that contained two books. There was the Qualities of Light, and there were the Qualities of Darkness. And you could read both books inside the one, depending on your own posture. And a lot of people did. A lot of people finished Zippy and said to me later, there was such a dark undertone to that book that I only sensed. I didn't know what it was. I just sensed it, which was what I intended. With this book, it was even, I think that's even more sharply conveyed, that there's this, there's so much that's not being said. But when I got to the end, when I got to this sort of dramatic, I either tell it or I'm not telling the truth.
Right.
Then I had to bring those shadows up in a new way. I mean, I had to illuminate that darkness in a new way. And so I did.
And we're not giving away what that thing is that happens at the end of the book, but it does go out with you laughing with your mother and makes one believe that you must be an optimist.
Yes, I certainly am. I think all evidence points toward that the world continues, and it continues to be a place of great sublimity and beauty. And that's no different just because I was 13.
Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, Eric.
Our thanks to Haven Kimmel. Her new book is called She Got Up Off the Couch and Other Heroic Acts from Moreland, Indiana. We'll be right back.